We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I am your host, Herschel Finn, and we've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we'll be interviewing Mr. Joshua Perlman, who is the head curator of the National Museum of American Jewish History. We've got lots of wonderful Jewish music scattered throughout the show. The portion of the week is the portion of Pinchas, which can be found in chapter 25 of the book of Numbers. We've got a really amazing story at the end. Stay through all the way before we do anything else. Let's go right to the news. Several unnamed hospitals were hit with a cyber attack overnight, but were able to continue functioning normally. No damage was caused by the attack. Ironically, the attack came hours after hundreds of cyber experts gathered in Tel Aviv for an annual cybersecurity conference. The hospital's computer systems continue to be monitored by Israel's Cyber Defense Authority. A rocket from Syria struck the Golan Heights in an open area. No injuries or damage was reported. The IDF destroyed the mortar site belonging to the Syrian regime from which the rocket was fired. An IDF soldier was attacked by an armed Arab terrorist during a mission to locate weapons in Hebron. I guess they found one. The terrorist was shot and killed. A rocket was fired from Gaza into an open area of Israel. No one was hurt. Israel responded by destroying two Hamas strongholds in Gaza. In other news, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear the restitution case from a 1997 Hamas bombing in Jerusalem in which survivors are seeking a $71.5 million judgment from Iran. Eight Americans who were injured in the suicide bombing sued Iran last year in U.S. District Court in Chicago for financing the attack and won a default judgment that Iran has refused to pay. Five people were killed and some 200 injured in the bombing. Arson destroyed an artfully decorated school bus owned by Levi Schreiber in Brooklyn. The bus appeared in the recent Ivri Anochi music video by Benny Fried. Police are investigating the arson as a hate crime. And finally, the city of Philadelphia passed a bill that would make vandalizing a cemetery punishable with a $2,000 per headstone fine and up to 3 years in jail. The bill comes 4 months after 200 headstones in a Jewish cemetery were destroyed. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program. Running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Mr. Joshua Perlman, who is the chief curator of the National Museum of American Jewish History, located in Philadelphia. How are you today, Josh?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is our honor. This week coming up is the 4th of July, American Independence Day. And since you're in the know, we want to talk about Jewish participation, collaboration, the opposite of collaboration, decollaboration, whatever you would call it, the part of the American Revolution. So let's go back a little bit, but even before that, when was the first migration of Jews to North America, Josh?
The first Jews came to permanently settle in what was then colonial America in 1654. And it's really a remarkable story about a couple of individuals who came directly to New Amsterdam, a colony, in search of economic opportunity, and of 23 Jews who came from Recife, Brazil, in search of religious freedom. The Portuguese had taken over Brazil from the Dutch and threatened to reimpose the Inquisition, and so these 23, some of the last to leave, sailed north to the Caribbean, where there was a large Jewish community at that time, and then up to North America, where eventually, after a little bit of a tension with the governor, Peter Stuyvesant, were able to settle in New Amsterdam and become part of the first permanent Jewish settlement in this country.
Was Peter Stuyvesant a Philo-Semite?
Well, Peter Stuyvesant was a Calvinist, and a very strict Calvinist. And, you know, he's often been portrayed as anti-Semitic, which in some respects was true, but he was actually someone who had absolutely no interest in any sort of religious pluralism. And so not only was he opposed to having Jews in his midst, he didn't really like the fact that there were Quakers there as well. So it took a bit of lobbying on the part of Jewish directors of the Dutch West India Company, but the decision was made that Jews had economic ties, you know, throughout the world, that they were generally involved in some sort of commercial or mercantile enterprise, and the 23 who came to New Amsterdam, they believe, could be of benefit to the colony, which was, for all intents and purposes, a startup.
Okay, so the Jews weren't, these 23 Jews weren't necessarily coming as, say, refugees with just the clothes on their back. They had, these were people of means a bit then.
Some of them were of means, and some of them, like those 23 coming from Brazil, were really, they were coming here in flight. They were some of the last to leave Brazil and were seeking a place of refuge. But what they brought with them were certainly connections to other Jewish communities around the Atlantic world.
Mm-hmm. Do we know any of the last names of those first Jews who came to North America?
We know very few of them, but one of them we do know, he made actually quite a mark on history, is Arthur Levy, who actually, there are streets named after him in New York City today, and he really helped to unburden the Jews who had come to New Amsterdam from a number of restrictions that had been placed on them.
Okay. So, yeah, if you're just joining us today, our guest today is Joshua Perlman, who's the head chief curator of the National Museum of American Jewish History. We're talking about hopefully getting to the American Revolution. We might just get stuck into, say, like the up to 1710 by the time. It's just so much to talk about, I gather. Okay, so now everybody knows the first synagogue in the United States, or the colonies, as the case may be, was the Tarot Synagogue in Rhode Island, not the synagogue in New Amsterdam. What happened there?
Well, actually, the first synagogue to be built was in what would then be called New York. The British had taken over the colony in 1730. The oldest standing synagogue in the United States is the Toro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island. And it's we have a model of the Toro Synagogue here in the museum in Philadelphia, and what's really fascinating about it is that externally it looks like any colonial building. In fact, it was designed by Peter Harrison, perhaps the most renowned architect of the time. But inside it, it looks like a very traditional Sephardic synagogue. And so that's, in some ways, points to the duality of Jewish identity in the colonial era, and in some ways a duality which continues to this day, which is about how to live integrated into American society, but also maintain tradition and religion and heritage.
I would imagine that the first synagogue then built in New York City is probably now occupied by some very many multi-storied building, Josh?
That first, that building is now no longer in existence. It was on Mill Street, which is down in the southern tip of Manhattan. But the building itself is lost to history.
Mm-hmm.
Like many cities, you know, building and rebuilding over time.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Okay, so let's jump up now. I guess, you know, we get to the time prior to the Boston Tea Party, you mean the Stamp Act thing, legislation that was going on, the tyranny of in the colonies, et cetera, as it is portrayed in our history books here in America. How by that time, when you're talking now the 1750s, 1760s, 1770s, what would you estimate maybe the Jewish population was out a couple thousand at that point?
The best estimate is somewhere around 2,000. Very, very small community living in the colonies at that time.
Okay, and how many are is the Savannah Synagogue been built yet at that point?
Right. So we have Jewish communities in Newport, New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, and Savannah.
Okay. So it's not, and if it's 2,000 in all five of those, it's not a whole lot in any one of them per se, specifically. Were they considered, well, for the most part then, Jews seem to go, have a tendency to hedge bets as to which side to go on involved, because when it comes to like wars and stuff, we know that the war is not involving us. So it's like, which side should we root for, you might say, or support would be to the greatest advantage, since the war is involving two other people, two other parties, and they're fighting over things that we really have no control about. So was the Jewish community, say, split in the 1760s, early 1770s, colonials versus the British?
Well, like most moments in some ways in history, you can find Jews on both sides of the equation. You can find Jews who were quite supportive of the Patriots and of the move towards independence, and you can find Jews who also were, you know, whether they were through business or through politics connected to the British, you can find Jewish loyalists as well. By and large, I would say that, you know, most Jews living in the colonies at that time supported independence and supported independence not only for as a political ideal, but also as the opportunity to stake their own claim for economic independence as well. There are moments like such as when the British invade or occupy New York, where you know Jews are presented with the choice to flee. Or the choice to declare their loyalty, and you find Jews doing both things. So the part of the Jewish community of New York actually comes down here to Philadelphia, led by Gershom Mendes Sathias, the Parnas of Sherith Israel, synagogue in New York at that time, and they join Mikveh Israel here in Philadelphia and stay throughout the Revolution, which is not to say that there aren't Jews who remained in New York and who took the oath of loyalty to the British.
Yeah, I was going to say, just somewhat tongue-in-cheek, that if they fled New York City, they had to go to New Jersey, but anyway. I can say that because I was born and raised in New Jersey. So were Jews officially welcomed in positions by the colonists? You know, I don't think any of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were Jewish. There was no Jews participating in the Continental Congresses. But what about in the workings of the fledgling government then, Joshua Perlman?
Certainly. Well, Jews were not signers on the Declaration of Independence, nor were they at the Constitutional Congress. Jews experienced a level of integration in the colonies and in the early Republic that was pretty remarkable for the world at that time. This is, we have stories of Jews participating in many ways in the revolutionary effort. Certainly, I think the most notable one is Chaim Solomon, who is referred to sometimes as the financier of the revolution, which is a bit of a hyperbole. He worked he worked to help secure loans for the Continental Army working under James Madison. Actually, in the museum here, we have a ledger in Madison's hand which notes, you know, many of the different people who were helping to secure loans, including Chaim Solomon, and it notes loans that he had secured on that particular day. It's a remarkable document and very unique.
I would imagine, but the Chaim Solomon, I think, put out money and never got paid back. Is that what the story was?
Well, he did help serve as a broker, and unfortunately for him, throughout the war and thereafter, he did incur a series of significant debts and died an early and untimely death, which led to his creditors, you know, collecting on those debts to the chagrin of his family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Okay, so now in the fight against the British, where do we? Well, there's only 2,000 Jews, so able-bodied men would put you probably around 500. So, and I'm not sure exactly how big the colony forces were fighting against the British, but it didn't seem like they probably got, like, if they did serve, they got lost. Or do we have any record of Jews fighting in the Revolutionary Army?
We have records of a few Jews fighting in the Revolutionary Army. I wish I could say we have a detail of every Jew who fought in the Revolutionary Army, but unfortunately, the records are just not revealing enough to tell us exactly how many Jews were involved. But. Mm-hmm. But there were definitely Jews who served and definitely Jews who were recognized for their service as part of the revolutionary effort.
Any indication as what the highest ranking Jew was in the colony army, Josh Perlman?
As far as I know, I guess what we would call GIs, you know, Jews who served in the general ranks of the army. I do not in particular know, and maybe one of your listeners out there will correct me, but I do not know of any Jews who served as officers in the Continental Army.
Okay, so now, has the National Museum of American Jewish History done anything to follow up on those original Jews from the 1700s to see where their ancestor, where their progeny are now today? Are there people who identify and say, my grandfather fought in the Revolutionary Army? Yes.
Well, we've been very lucky that there has been a considerable amount of genealogical work done over decades and decades, charting the trajectories of many of those first families. And, we've been fortunate to have some of those families visit the museum over the course of our 7 years. But if you think about these tiny 2000s and then the nearly 300 years over 300 years that have taken place since the time of the revolution, the nearly two...
You have 2,000 Jews over 300 years. You're talking possibly hundreds of thousands of progeny.
Right. So the families have become, you know, very diversified, very very spread out. But nevertheless, many people, you know, there's a significant group of people who can trace their lineage back to that. And it's been wonderful to host them here at the museum when they've come.
It would be interesting to get some sort of a demographic of how many of those still recognize themselves as being Jewish. How many have the melting pot sucked in and just became regular members of the DAR, as the case may be?
This I don't have statistics on, although you raise an interesting question.
Yeah, like what did happen? Okay, so the revolution happened, and as far as I could tell, I think we won the war, even though 1812 would kind of like, you know, came back and they tried to get us again, but we won that one. So the Washington set up his federal government in New York and Philadelphia. Eventually it wound up a couple presidents later down in Washington. Were Jews involved with the federal government?
Jews have been involved in the aspects of the federal government from pretty early on. Whether that's as official employees of the federal government or involved in helping to set policy or advocating for certain policies, certainly during the period of Washington's presidency, there was very active advocacy by Jews and by Jewish Americans on behalf of preserving religious liberty in the new nation, and certainly probably the best representative document which we have in the museum is Washington's response to the Hebrew congregation at Newport, in which he pledged that very famous phrase that the government of the United States would give to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. And in some sense, Jews as the smallest or Jews as the largest religious minority in the new nation played a significant role in ensuring that there would be religious liberty and religious freedom as the policy of the new country.
Okay, so who was the first, say, Jewish senator? Would you know that one? We're doing Jewish trivia now. Josh Perlman. First Jewish senator was Charles Schumann, the first Jewish senator from New York.
Unfortunately, this I don't have the answer to.
Okay, fair enough. What about the first Jewish millionaire or magnate?
The first Jewish millionaire or magnate. So now we're getting into trivia that's... that is not, I will say, trivia is not my forte.
Okay.
But you certainly have Jews moving into the 19th century who are making fortunes, whether that's in the early years of industrialization or in the South in the plantation system. Certainly one of the most, I would say, recognizable names that we know is Toro, because Judah Toro, the Toro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island, which we spoke about earlier, is named for Judah Toro because when he died, he spread his fortune amongst a number of Jewish causes, including ensuring that synagogue would be preserved and would remain in operation throughout the ages.
Okay, cool. I think I don't remember his name, but I think the first Jew who moved to Michigan, like moved to the upper UP, and he actually planted a farm which grew rye. And the rye was not for making deli rye bread, because the deli I don't think had been invented or had come to America yet, but he used it for making whiskey, which was a much more valuable commodity at that time than cornbread, than corned beef, as the case may be. So...
Mm-hmm.
So we're there all over the place. Okay, this is going to do it for us. Our guest today has been Joshua Perlman. He's the chief curator of the National Museum of American Jewish History. How are things going at the National Museum of American Jewish History? It's been in existence it's getting close to a decade. It's like 7-8 years that the doors have been open.
Yes, this November will be our 7th year open in our new building on Independence Mall. It's an incredibly exciting time for the museum right now. We have a lot of great activities going on throughout the summer. And for anybody who's visiting Philadelphia over the holiday week, they can see the final weeks of our new special exhibition, 1917, How One Year Changed the World, which commemorates the centennial of America's entry into World War I, the Russian Revolution, and the Balfour Declaration, all of which happened in that one year.
That was
and
the year that was.
The world.
Yes, indeed. Okay. And if people want to, say, take a virtual tour or get more information about the National Museum of American Jewish History, don't tell me it's the website is NationalMuseumOfAmericanJewishHistory.com. That takes up my entire browsing. So what is the website, Josh?
It's close. For anybody interested in visiting or learning more about our programs, they can visit us at www.nmajh.org.
Okay, and that stands for National Museum of American Jewish History. Okay, that's going to wrap it up for this section of the show. Joshua Perlman, head curator of the National Museum of American Jewish History, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your knowledge and enlightening us.
Thank you very much, and have a happy holiday week.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. This song that we're going to be playing now, very unusual, the prominence of it. The author is Ruvi New, or should I say Rabbi Reuven New, who is a rabbi in the synagogue in East Boca Raton, Florida. And I happen to know Ruvi. I didn't mean to ask, was this a product of a midlife crisis? Or maybe he felt like his youth is fleeting away. He felt like he had to write an album. It happens to be that the world has been missing out, I would say, probably for the last 25 years. He should have done this 25 years ago because it is actually very good. My hat's off to Ruvi New. And we're going to listen to the title song of his latest CD. It's called Storm the World.
Osimar, been making your deal, building your home, gathering sparks wherever we've gone. Kisay na oir abo min achoyshev, but admosai till kiva oirech till that final day when umala oretz deyo. Es Hashem, mit der Sturm, mit storm the world. Storm, our flag is unfurled. In my own eyes, I could saw like never before. Did I know that we're winning the war? We touched the rim, let's storm the world. Before I stole, our flag is unfurled. In my own eyes, I could saw like never before. Did I know that we're winning the war? But I like a scheme, coming in me, us like saying. With our heads held high, we're marching on the road to the Geula. Altiro, we're crouching no more. With a lion's roar, we are rising again.
higher than ever before. Mit der Sturm, let's storm the world. Vorratst du, our flag is unfurled. Die Mayone sachut so like never before. Die Danok sachu winning the war. Mit der Sturm, let's storm the world. Vorratst du, our flag is unfurled. Die Mayone sachut so like never before. Die Danok sach. We're winning the war. Mit der Sturm, let's storm the world. Before that storm, our flag is unfurled. My honest achutz are like never before. Die da notza, we're winning the war. Mit der Sturm, let's storm the world. Before that storm, our flag is unfurled. My honest achutz are like never before. Die da notza. We're winning the war. Care our belt, turn over the world. Yom of a game until the call is heard. Care our belt, high. So fine of a neck, let's light up the night. Whoa.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Up next, this is brand new. It's less than 72 hours old. The singer is Shulam Lemmer, who is a rising star in the Jewish recording scene, singing together with the Yochi Brisman Orchestra. This is a Yiddish classic, a standard called Abigazunt, just so long as you're healthy.
Bissel zin, a bissel regen, a ruhig Ohr, dem Kopf zu legen, a wie gesinnt, kämmen glücklich sein. A schich a so, kleidet und lattes in Keschene, a dreif is lattes, a wie gesinnt, kämmen glücklich sein. Die Luft is frei, fahr jeden Glas. Scheint für jeden Ehe, nur im Mode reich. A bissl Freund, a bissl Lachen, a Moment Freund, a Schnäpsel machen, a wie gesinnt, kämmen glücklich sein. Eine sich gewirrt, eine sich taschiert, einem in der ganzen Welt. Eine meint, der ganze Glück hängt nur auf auf Geld. Scheint für jeden Ehre, nur im Oder reich. machen am Umet frei A Schnäpsel machen am Ugesinn Kämmen glücklich sein Kämmen glücklich sein
Shulam Lemmer singing a Abigazunt. Up next, this is Shlomo Carlbach saying, He who makes peace above should make peace down here below. Let's listen in.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Pinchas can be found in the book of Numbers, chapters 25 and following. The first part of the portion talks about Pinchas, because after all, it is the name of the portion, and Pinchas was Aaron's grandson, who was the one who saved the plague caused by the desecration of God's name, caused in the end of last week's portion. Refer there. The last half of the portion, in chapter 28 and on, 26 and on, 28 and on, yeah, 27, talks about sacrifices that were offered in the temple on a regular basis. And it lists there first the daily sacrifices, and then the sacrifices on the new moon, on Shabbos, then the new moon, and then all the ensuing holidays. And those listed on the Shabbos and the new moon, etc., were called the Musaf sacrifices, the additional sacrifices. So what it says about the daily sacrifices is, and this is actually incorporated in our daily prayers, Es lachmi, that my sacrifice should be my bread for a fire offering. Now, when you say bread, what do people do with bread? Duh, they eat it. And why do they eat it? Because it's filling. We are a wheat economy, you might say. We eat bread and have done so for millennia. But here it says that the sacrifices are God's bread. So what's up with that? Does God get hungry? The answer is no, of course not. Not as we would think, because we don't believe in God having any corporeality, any physical body. But rather, bread is a sustenance. And what is it that keeps us going is the calories that we're consuming, that we are consuming, we're ingesting. We see, for example, coming up in a week from Tuesday begins a period known as the 3 weeks. It is the time which is marked the prior to the destruction of the temples, both of them. This next Tuesday, a week from the 11th, is a week from this Tuesday, which would be the 11th, marks the day the last time that a sacrifice was offered in Jerusalem. You know, the story goes that the city of Jerusalem was under siege for 3 years by Titus, the Roman, who wanted to destroy the city. Because the Romans understood, as long as Jerusalem's existence exists and the temple is functioning, they would not be dominant supreme. So they knew they had to destroy it. Nebuchadnezzar knew this as well. That's why he destroyed it. They laid siege to the city, and there's all kinds of stories, which we read about on Tisha B'Av, and which I do every year at conjunction with Jewish Ferndale, but we do it jointly together with the Woodward Avenue Shul, which is located, believe it or not, on Woodward, just north of the zoo, and that would be in a month from now. That would be, I think that's, I don't have the date, whatever that Tuesday, that Monday night is, the first Monday of August. So we usually get down for a meal over there, and then we do the evening prayers, the Book of Lamentations, and followed by yours truly telling Tisha B'Av stories well into the night until the last person says, okay, I've had enough, which usually goes, yeah, last year we went till about 1 o'clock in the morning. It's a tradition that was started by the Finman children because they didn't want to go to sleep way back when. So I said, okay, get in your pajamas and we'll read Tisha B'Av stories. And we all got into our pajamas and we sat on the floor, as people are wont to do during Tisha B'Av, during the holiday. And we told stories about the destruction of the temple. So comes now, the city is under siege. Every day, the Romans had it, they had said, this is great, you know. Not only are they, they're paying us basically to lay siege to their, to attack their city, because the Jews needed sheep. They needed a minimum of 2 sheep every single day, one for the morning, one for the afternoon sacrifice. And what they would do is they made some kind of arrangement that they would lower down a basket over the wall, which was filled with gold. And the Romans would put 2 sheep in it. And this went on for 3 years. One day, an apostatized Jew, meaning a Jew who gave up his Judaism and began siding with the Romans, a renegade, said, you know, you're self-defeating yourself. You think you're getting wealthy over here. But as long as you keep giving them sheep, you're never going to be able to conquer them. So they said, okay, fine, let's see. The next day came the basket of gold. And instead of putting the 2 sheep into the basket, they put a pig. Pigs are not kosher. You can't offer a pig on the altar. 3 weeks later, the temple was destroyed. So we see that there is a certain establishment of health, you might say, with the sacrifices, as a person who eats is much healthier than a person who doesn't eat. When the base of Mikdash, when the temple was going to be built, the first one by King David, he was planning the city of Jerusalem. So he was told, you're not going to build the temple. Your son is going to build the temple because you're a man of war and this is a house of peace. So you are not going to build it. But he said, David, being very smart, said to God, wait, if a person's going to build it, that means it's going to fall apart because people can't do anything that's eternal. And indeed, the first temple only lasted 410 years. And the second one only lasted 420 years. Which is not a long time in the scheme of how much time there is. So he said, what are the Jews supposed to do to supply you with their bread, you might say, even though it does say that in any generation in which the temple was not built, it is considered as though they destroyed it, because the status quo in Judaism is that we have a temple. And what Jews are doing at this point is preventing the temple from being built. So as soon as we remove that block, the temple will be automatically built. It should be speedily in our day. So the Almighty said that their prayers will replace their sacrifices. So now, when a Jew comes to the Almighty in prayer, and prayer doesn't mean necessarily going to the synagogue and turning pages and keeping up with the person who's leading the prayers. Prayers is a feeling of relating heart to heart to the Almighty. And that then becomes the bread of the Almighty. Why did the Almighty bother making a creation? Ultimately, I don't know. I can't say that quite clearly. But part of that whole deal was, is so that a person should be able to turn towards the Almighty, recognize the Almighty's presence in this, what my mother would say, God-forsaken world. It's not forsaken. It's just God. You can't see God. But if a person perceives God's presence, the Almighty says, that's enough. That's like, for me, having a good meal, however we define that good meal. So then we have, it moves on to very quickly, we have the different sacrifices. You have the things which are called the tamid, the continual sacrifice, which were offered every single day, twice a day, doesn't matter what day of the year it was, every single day, a lamb in the morning, a lamb in the afternoon. Then you had, on the new moon, on the Shabbos, you had extra ones which were offered somewhere in between. The first sacrifice in the day was the morning one, and the last sacrifice in the day was the afternoon one, with a whole bunch of sacrifices in between. So somewhere in the middle of the day, on Rosh Chodesh, on Shabbos, on the holidays, etc., they would offer these additional sacrifices. Our prayers take the place. Every single day we pray three times a day in the synagogue. Our morning prayers take the place of the morning sacrifices. Our afternoon prayers take the place of the afternoon sacrifices. And our evening prayers take place of the services that they did on the altar in the burning of the various sacrificial parts, which lasted almost the whole night. And so when we're talking about our relationship with the Almighty and giving bread to the Almighty, so did you eat this morning? Did you eat yesterday morning? Can we possibly guess that tomorrow you're going to eat as well? So every day you eat, even though you got fed yesterday, it's like, what have you done for me lately? I'm hungry now. It's the Almighty as well. Every day is like it's that we believe that the Almighty creates every day anew. We go to sleep, the world is the way it is. We wake up, it's a new day. It's a new beginning. Today is the first day of the rest of your life, and other such cliches. So now we have a new way, a continuous way of relating to the Almighty and make today count. That's going to take us for this. Let's go break for a commercial. Don't go away. We've got a great Hasidic story coming up. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard. The Spex Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48 22220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Easiest way? Drop me a line, whatever it is. You got a comment about anything, a criticism, a question. I don't even care what the topic is. Send me a letter at rabbifinman.com. Go to my website. Click on the Contact Us page. You get to contact me on rabbifinman.com. There's also a year and a half episodes of The Jewish Hour. If you missed anything, want to hear something over again, that's wonderful. You'll also find our archived edition of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story as conveyed in classes, conveyed by yours truly in a hopefully entertaining and educational way. You'll also find the very important donations page. Thank God. It's the beginning of July, and we paid April. Yes. Thank you so much for coming through. This last week, some major contributions were received, and we thank you. I've thanked them all personally in writing, and now I'm thanking them all personally via the air. Keep those cards and letters coming, folks. We need it. So now, guess what? So now we have May, June, and July. So we're not getting kicked off so fast, but we're still behind. But like my grandmother would say, better to be a little behind than a big behind. And so let's not make us a big behind over here and go to your computer, go to the donations page of rabbifinman.com, click on a number, write your own number in, make it a monthly thing if that makes life easier for you. If you can't do $100 in one time, fine, $10 a month is great. If you could do 100,000, that's also good. Any number is good for us. And if you do not like internet giving because you're worried about security and fraud, listen, there was a whole convention this week in Israel of the smartest minds of combating cyber terrorism. It's a real thing, I understand. You can drop your donation of any amount, and you can do this anywhere. If you're listening anywhere in the world, you can put a stamp on an envelope and put a donation into the envelope, and it will get to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Do it today, please, because we have a thing. You know, if we pay off May, June, and July, like, say, next week, I don't ask again until August. And if it gets so much that I actually get May, June, July, and August, I won't ask for August either. So it's totally up to you guys. If you want to hear me do this, you want to hear me say a longer story, totally up to you. The story actually involves the Arizal, whose yahrzeit is coming up. The anniversary of his passing is coming up with a couple weeks. So he was learning with his number one student. His name was Chaim Vital. And a 14-year-old boy walked in the door. The Arizal stood up and said, "Shalom Aleichem, please sit down." Which was totally out of character for the Arizal, that he should stand up for some teenager kid? What? And he also noticed that the kid was wearing Sabbath clothing, which we're supposed to wear better clothing on a Shabbos than we do during the rest of the week. After this Chaim Vital was totally amazed, and he said, he was like totally befuddled. When the kid left, so he asked his Rebbe, the Arizal, "Why did you stand up for that kid and give him shalom like that?" He said, "There is no way that I would stand up for a kid and give him shalom. But when that young man walked in walked in with him the vigils of Pinchas ben Yair, who was a person who appeared in the Talmud, actually in the Mishnah, I believe, and it was for him who I stood up and gave the honor." And he said, "Why did this kid have Pinchas ben Yair coming around with him?" He said, "Well, he did a very special mitzvah today. And because he did that very special mitzvah, something that Pinchas ben Yair would have done, Pinchas ben Yair is now accompanying him for the day." So what was it? He said, "You go ask him. If he wants to tell you or not, it's not my place." I guess they had like HIPAA laws among prophets back then. So he ran after the kid and he caught up to him and said, "Tell me, what's anything special happened today in your life?" And he said, "No, I just went up." And he said, "Well, there's this one incident." He said, I was on my way to the synagogue this morning for prayers. You have to understand, in Sfat, at that time, they davened, they prayed the morning prayers such that they were at the crescendo at dawn, which meant that they first had to go to the mikveh and had to do the prep. So if it would be in the summertime, for example, so this kid would have had to have gotten up at 3 o'clock in the morning, which people do today. And he said, as I was coming near to the synagogue, I heard crying coming from a house. And I walked in and I saw that there was a family there and the house had been ransacked and they were sitting there in their underwear. And I said, what happened? And he said, we were attacked by thieves last night and they stole everything of worth in our house, even our clothes. So he said, what did I do? Is I immediately took off my clothing and gave it to the father and then ran home because it was still dark out and put on my Sabbath clothes, which I still have on right now. And with that, so the Chaim Vital understood that Pinchas Ben Yair, who was best known for redeeming captives and helping the poor, was indeed accompanying this young man. That's going to do it for today. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. Hope to see you back again next week. Take care. May I come?